There was no reception anywhere near this village.
"Tell him I want to see his phone," he said.
Jumbo bobbed his head up and down as the man spoke, and then turned back to Harvath.
"He doesn't have it anymore."
"Where is it?"
"He hid it in one of their trucks. The men who killed everyone in the clinic, and then killed everyone in the village."
"Why?"
"He was worried that he would be killed too," said Jumbo. "There is no cellular service here. He pressed send, and then hid the phone in a truck. He assumed that eventually the truck would pass into an area with reception, and the message would be sent."
"Smart."
Harvath had to give the man credit. There was something, though, that was bothering him.
"How did he know where to send it? How did he know the email address?"
Decker cleared her throat, and all eyes turned to her as she looked at Harvath.
"Didn't you see all the signs in the clinic?" she asked. "The banners?"
Harvath had seen lots of things, but he had been focused on figuring out what had happened.
"What signs?"
"The ones advertising CARE International's support of the clinic. Each of them has CARE's web address, as well as an email for more information. That's the address the video was sent to." Harvath turned his attention back to the villager and said to Jumbo,
"Tell him I want to know about the trucks."
Jumbo asked him, and the man rattled off a short description. There were no distinctive colors or markings. They appeared to be commercial, not military. Nothing special.
"How about the men themselves?"
"Mzungu,"
the villager replied.
"What's Mzungu?" Harvath asked.
"It's Swahili for white people," said Decker.
"White people?"
She nodded.
Harvath asked Jumbo,
"Were they military?"
Seconds later, he replied, "Apparently they carried rifles, but they were not wearing uniforms."
"How about their hair? Long, short, any beards, mustaches, tattoos, anything at all that stood out?"
Jumbo asked the man and then said,
"They acted military. One man gave orders and the others followed. They all had short hair, no beards, no mustaches, no tattoos."
"How many were there?"
"He says somewhere between 8 to 12.
About the size of a military squad, Harvath thought.
"What language were they speaking?"
Jumbo translated the question and then said,
"He's not sure. He didn't recognize it. He says, maybe German or Russian."
"Would he recognize any of them if he saw them again?"
Jumbo asked the man and then nodded. Harvath stepped outside, retrieved a pen and a piece of paper, and walked back into the dwelling.
"Tell him I need his cell phone number," he said, handing the pen and paper to Jumbo.
Once he had it, he left Decker with Jumbo to ask more questions and stepped back outside. Positioning his Iridium system, he fired up his phone, waited until it had a strong signal, and then placed his call. When the man on the other end picked up, he apologized for waking him and then said,
"I need you to locate a phone for me.
It was tossed into a truck in Congo several days ago. The battery is probably dead, but I want to know all the other towers it touched. I also want a list of phones that touched those same towers at the same time, as well as where those phones are now."
"How soon do you need it?" the man asked.
"Right away," Harvath replied.
Ending the call, he stepped back inside to join Decker. Jumbo was in the middle of translating the villager's tale. His name was Léonce, and he talked about a stranger who had shown up at the Matoumeni clinic, sick with a high fever. No one knew how he had gotten there. He lost consciousness soon after coming in. He had no ID, no money, nothing. They placed him in a bed, started an IV, and began trying to figure out who he was and what was wrong with him. He regained consciousness twice, but only briefly. Both times he screamed to be protected and begged the clinic staff not to send him back. They were never able to figure out what he was talking about. A nurse said she thought he might be Muslim, a very minority community in Congo, as it sounded at one point as if he had moaned the word for the Muslim god Allah. Per their protocols, they contacted the health ministry hotline in Kinshasa. The rather blasé bureaucrat told them it was probably nothing, but to take full protective measures. An hour later, the clinic received a call from the World Health Organization representative in Kinshasa, telling them to prep blood and tissue samples and deliver them to the airport in Bunia for transport. The rep also asked to be emailed pictures of the patient. The clinic had one very small, very old, and very unreliable car. Léonce offered to make the trip to Bunia. When the clinic staff agreed, Léonce invited his son, the deaf boy named Pepsi, to come with him. The staff took great pains to make sure the samples were completely airtight and properly packaged. Léonce was given money for fuel. Any food or lodging would be his responsibility. They had already given him all the petty cash they had. Léonce had been to Bunia many times and knew the route well. He had a relative there, and he and Pepsi would spend the night before returning the next morning. With their package safely on the back seat, Léonce ground the gears of the little car. He and Pepsi waved out their open windows to the staff, and they began their journey. Their problems began almost immediately. First came the rain. It was so heavy, it sounded like rocks being poured onto the roof of the car. Each enormous drop landed with a great splash. Léonce activated the wipers. They swung to the left, they swung to the right. Then, they stopped. He and his son had tried to use their shirts to keep the windshield clear, but the rain was so bad that they could barely see the road. Then, they hit a roadblock.
Roadblock? Harvath asked.
It would be more appropriate to designate it a toll, Jumbo clarified. Bandits set them up to extort money from motorists.
Ash and Mick, who had been listening to the interrogation, shot Harvath a look.
Does Léonce know who these bandits were? Harvath asked.
Jumbo nodded.
FRPI, the Front for the...
Patriotic Resistance of Ituri, Harvath said,
finishing the translator's sentence for him.
What happened?
They demanded Mr. Léonce pay their toll. He had very little money with him. When they tried to take his package from the back seat, he struggled with them. One of the rebels struck him in the stomach with the butt of his rifle.
And then what happened?
They wanted to know why Mr. Léonce was so protective of the package. They thought maybe he was transporting drugs. They moved his car to the side of the road and took him and his boy to see their commander.
Harvath looked at Decker. He could tell that she was thinking the same thing he was.
Then what?
The commander did not believe Mr. Léonce. He opened the package and dumped out its contents. He says one of the vials broke.
Ask him to describe the commander.
Jumbo did and replied,
medium height, medium build, 35, with a thick scar across his forehead.
Shit,
Decker exclaimed. Harvath couldn't have put it better himself.
So much for yellow fever, he said to her.
We still don't know enough,
she replied, composing herself.
I know enough,
he stated, turning back to Jumbo.
Keep going.
Mr. Léonce and his son were allowed to leave. They repacked the box and drove to Bunia. The plane they were supposed to meet had already taken off, so they had to wait until the following day for the next one. The car gave them trouble on the way back. They had no money for repairs, so they left it with a mechanic in a village several kilometers away and walked back. When they arrived at their village, they saw their animals being slaughtered and thrown into the back of a truck. None of the other villagers were anywhere to be seen. They ran through the jungle toward the clinic. They could hear gunshots from the area where they burned the trash. When they got to the edge of the clearing, they ducked down and watched as a group of four men put on protective suits. It was then that Mr. Léonce thought to film what he saw. The men walked into the clinic and began shooting. The rest of the story you already know.
And Mr. Léonce and his son have been in hiding ever since?
Harvath asked. Jumbo nodded. Harvath was about to say something else when his phone chimed. Chapter 22. Even though his digital guru Nicholas was groggy and angry from having been awakened at such an ungodly hour back in the States, he had made quick work of the assignment Harvath had given him. With his laptop balanced on the hood of LC-1, Harvath scrolled through the satellite images. Nicholas had highlighted all the cell towers that Leonce's phone had shaken hands with. The pictures drew a path back to Bunya.
"That's not good," Ash said over Harvath's shoulder.
He didn't bother turning to look at him.
"What do you see?"
The Brit reached over, put his finger on a cluster of buildings near a cell tower on Harvath's screen and said, "Manusco HQ."
"Let me guess," Harvath replied. "That's Swahili for Rebel Central."
"Worse. United Nations Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. MINUSCO is the acronym for the official name in French. You could probably pronounce it, but I don't parler le frog."
The historical animosity between the French and the Brits always made him laugh.
"Why is it worse than Rebel Central?"
"You ever work with a UN Stabilization Force?" Ash asked.
Harvath shook his head.
"Then trust me. As the old saying goes, you can't spell unprofessional, unethical, or unaccountable without the UN. The cholera outbreak the old blue helmets caused in Haiti? Over 10,000 dead, and it has spread to the Dominican Republic and Cuba. The rapes and sex crimes they have committed in Mali and everywhere else? The stories of their depravity and brutality are legion. Their entire military, if you can call it that, is shot through with corruption and rampant lack of accountability. They even allowed two of their own unarmed military observers in Bunya to get slaughtered years ago because none of their fellow UN troops wanted to risk a rescue operation. They're pathetic."
UN troops were indeed known for a lack of honor and discipline. Harvath was familiar with the horror stories surrounding their deployments. He could think of no greater nightmare than to have his country reliant upon the UN to provide peace and stability. He'd rather take his chances combating whatever was causing the war and instability in the first place. A fish rots from the head down, and any organization that boasted a human rights council, yet accepted human rights violators like China, Cuba, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and even slavery-infested Mauritania as members, couldn't be taken seriously, much less be expected to police and field an effective and honorable military. In short, Harvath didn't have much use for the UN.
"What about this?" Harvath asked, advancing to another image.
"Downtown Bunya," said Ash, "about 3 clicks from the hotel we stayed at."
Harvath pushed a button and the red dots representing cell towers dimmed, and a cluster of green dots became visible.
"What do those represent?" Ash asked.
"Opportunity," Harvath replied.
Decker felt certain about one thing. If Leonce and his son were not already exhibiting symptoms of whatever illness they were looking at, they likely weren't going to. Her emphasis on the word likely didn't put Harvath or the security team at ease. None of the men were willing to roll their personal dice on her assessment. She had signed on to be a doctor and willingly commune with the sick of Africa. They hadn't. After Harvath gave her a wad of bills, Jumbo drove Decker to the village where Leonce had left the clinic's vehicle. The repairs had been minimal, and the car was already waiting. She and Jumbo returned 20 minutes later. In an act of solidarity, she would be driving back to Bunya with Leonce and his son, while the rest of the team rode in the Land Cruisers. Decker didn't have to worry about the harrowing river crossings they had conducted on their way in. Her little vehicle would never make it. They had to go far out of their way and cut back toward Bunya. All the while, Harvath and the security team were keeping their eyes peeled for roadblocks. None of them had any desire to bump up against the FRPI again. Their trek was long, but thankfully uneventful. When they arrived at the Bunya Hotel, it was well after dark. After checking in, they unloaded all of their gear and secured it in their rooms. Ever eager to spread money around the family, Jumbo had offered to ring up his relatives and have them come back and babysit the trucks, but Ash had said it wasn't necessary. Harvath, though, thought he might have another use for them. Those green dots on his laptop earlier corresponded to 6 cell phones Nicholas had traced to a walled concrete structure on the other side of town. It reminded Harvath of a poor man's version of the Bin Laden compound in Abbottabad. He wanted to do a drive-by, and Ash had agreed to go with him. They brought Jumbo just in case. When the hotel security guard opened the gates, Ash put the Land Cruiser in gear and pulled out into evening traffic. Motorbikes carrying passengers, known as Boda Boda, weaved in and out between cars, while bicycle riders piloting Black Mambas, so named because they left trails in the dust that resembled those of the deadly snake, grabbed onto trucks and other vehicles to hitch free rides. Harvath and Ash kept their Glocks under their thighs, hidden from sight. The GPS system on Harvath's phone guided them toward their target. Along the streets, small, ramshackle shops sold everything from cheap Chinese televisions to cooking pots. Harvath had long held that with its incredible resources, Africa should be the most powerful continent on the planet. But because of its tribalism and terrible governments, it was relegated to permanent third world status. Seeing it firsthand always made him appreciate even more what he had back at home. Thinking of back home, he checked his phone again. Lara still hadn't texted him back. It was for the best. He didn't have time to get involved in any additional drama. His time with Decker in the jungle shower had been bad enough. Decker hadn't liked being rebuffed, but that was her problem. He had tried to make it clear that he wasn't interested. She had persisted anyway, sensing that there may have been some sort of opening with him. She had been wrong. When she had stepped into the shower and had tried to press herself up against him, that's when he steered her back out and told her in no uncertain terms what the situation was. He couldn't have been the first man to say no to her, but watching the Brits continue to drool all over her, he wondered if maybe he was. Not that it mattered to him. He had something much better waiting for him at home, provided he could salvage it. His fidelity seemed to turn Decker on even more. That, or she saw it as a challenge. In either case, he was glad to not have to ride to Bunia with her and was equally pleased to be away from the hotel and not have to deal with her there. Nearing the compound, he tried to put Lara, Decker, and everything else out of his mind. They would only get one look tonight, and as their Land Cruiser rolled slowly by, he took in everything. The wall heights, window and door placement, the lighting, security measures, adjacent buildings, as well as all of the nearby businesses. "I vote no," Ash stated as they kept on going. Harvath looked at him.
"No to what?"
"No to everything you're thinking right now."
"How do you know what I'm thinking?"
"The same way I knew yesterday morning that you wouldn't radio us, even if it did go tits up out in the jungle."
"Technically, you said to call only if it went pear-shaped," Harvath replied.
"Are you taking the piss now? Is that what this is?"
"No, but that's a good idea. Pull over."
"I didn't say take a piss," Ash clarified. "I said taking the piss. It means..."
"I know what it means," said Harvath. "And yes, I'm pulling your chain. But I still want you to pull over. Up there by that bar. Pardon me, by that pub."
"I know what a bar is, you nonce." Harvath smiled.
"Just taking the piss again. Don't worry."
"Something tells me I'm going to have plenty to worry about soon enough," Ash replied, as he pulled off the road and put the Land Cruiser in park. From the back seat, Jumbo looked out his window at the bar and asked,
"Are we going in for a beer?"
"Ash and I are," said Harvath. "You're going for a walk."
Chapter 23. Sunday. With his earbuds in, Jumbo had pretended to be FaceTiming on his iPhone as he strolled the neighborhood and shot video. When they had reviewed it back at the hotel, Harvath and Ash were able to identify several places for static surveillance, plus launching pads if they needed to go dynamic. Harvath had no plans to attempt to breach the compound. However this went down, he wanted it to go down outside. The next morning, They used Jumbo and three of his relatives as cutouts to temporarily secure two second-story apartments and access to a handful of rooftops ringing the target compound. Even in a backwater like Congo, cell phone technology would allow Harvath and the team to feed images back to the Bunya Hotel. If Leonce and his son recognized any of the men, Decker would reply with a text. With that said, there were limits to how clear a picture a camera phone would take. Harvath hadn't come equipped for a surveillance assignment with long lenses and spotting scopes. They would have to make do with what they had. Ash and the team had binoculars, but they didn't have anti-flare lenses, so they were restricted to the apartments and forbidden from roof duty. The team was operating under the assumption that they were dealing with active or former military personnel. From the little Jumbo had been able to ascertain mingling in the market and throughout the neighborhood, the house they were surveilling was known by locals as the White House. It wasn't a reference to the building in Washington, D.C., but rather to this structure's occupants, all of whom were said to be white men. The team decided they would use the same name. No one knew who the occupants of the White House were. Though sometimes seen on foot, they usually came and went in nondescript SUVs. They all wore sunglasses and had short haircuts. That was the extent of the description people in the neighborhood were able to provide. It was enough for Harvath. They sat on the White House for 32 humid hours before the package Harvath had requested from Nicholas arrived. Ash sent Jumbo to the airport with bribe money to pick it up and make sure nothing happened to it.
"What is it?"
Mick asked as Harvath opened the box and lifted the item out.
"It's a Predator."
"As in the drone?"
Harvath shook his head.
"No, this technology preys on human weakness."
"What?"
"Give me your cell phone."
Mick handed it over.
"Now, give me your Glock."
"Why?"
Harvath motioned for him to hand it over, and Mick complied. Turning the weapon in his hand, Harvath prepared to strike the face of the phone with the butt of the weapon when Mick intervened.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," he said.
Harvath smiled.
"Exactly."
Handing them back, he stated,
"That's what I'm counting on."
Included in the delivery from the Carlton Group was additional surveillance equipment, which they parceled out among their observation posts, along with tiny wireless cameras for the rooftops. Leonce had already identified two of the suspects, but as better imagery came rolling in, Harvath fed the pictures back to the hotel, and Leonce grew more emphatic that they were onto the right group of men. Harvath agreed. They were pros. The men did everything right when they entered or exited the compound. This was not some JV team. Their heads were on swivels, and they took their time. Nothing was rushed. Everything was smooth and by the book. In addition to sending the pictures back to the hotel, Harvath had also been funneling all of the camera phone imagery back to his office in Virginia. So far, there hadn't been any hits via facial recognition. That didn't necessarily mean anything. The men wore sunglasses and baseball caps. With such poor resolution, it was tough to tag the appropriate markers. Now that the new cameras had arrived, Harvath was confident they'd know who the men were soon enough. Back at the Carlton Group offices, Nicholas had been tracing the calls from their cell phones, the majority of which were going to South Africa. There was one phone inside the house, though, that Nicholas couldn't crack or trace. It was heavily encrypted and not like anything he'd ever seen before. He warned Harvath about it and told him that if he did end up hitting the house, to make sure he bagged all of the phones. Nicholas couldn't tell him what specifically to look for because he didn't know himself.
"Just bring me all the phones and I'll sort it out," is what he had said.
Harvath, though, hadn't changed his mind. He still had no intention of taking the house down. There was no telling how many men were inside, how well armed they were, and what kind of resources they could muster if they got into a firefight. The last thing Harvath and his team needed were armored personnel carriers full of UN troops rolling down the street and banging away at them. The United Nations spent over $1.5 billion a year keeping 20,000 troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It was their largest and most expensive area of focus. The UN had divided the DRC into six sectors, and Bunia was the seat of Sector 6. Other than their phones pinging off a cell tower near the MINUSCO HQ, there was nothing to connect the men inside the White House to the United Nations. What was interesting, though, was that of all the countries who had sent troops to be part of the MINUSCO Stabilization Force, only four others had sent as many or more than South Africa. Harvath was willing to bet that a high prevalence of South African troops in the UN Stabilization Force and calls back and forth from the target house to South Africa weren't a coincidence. What they needed was to identify not only when the black phone, as Nicholas had dubbed it, was moving, but also who specifically was carrying it. The phone had already left the compound once and returned, but had done so at night in a two-vehicle convoy carrying eight men. Harvath and his team had watched the needle and the haystack roll right past them, but hadn't been able to learn much about either. It was one of the reasons Harvath hated surveillance work. It could not only be mind-numbingly boring, but incredibly frustrating. And if you were working with the wrong people, tensions could quickly mount. To their credit, Ash and his SAS crew were thorough professionals. Nobody in their right mind enjoyed surveillance, but the Brits approached it with a sense of humor, making fun of different people and things they saw happening down on the street, as well as directing jibes at each other, help pass the time. Jumbo was an excellent cook, and they supplemented his meals with Chinese and Indian takeout from the hotel. With two long lenses, as well as IR cameras that could capture much better nighttime imagery, they recorded as much as they could and beamed it all back to the United States for analysis. As they did, Nicholas's facial recognition and data mining programs began to return hits. The men were not South African military. They were former South African military. Rekkies, former special forces from the 5 Special Forces Regiment based in Falabora in northern Limpopo province. Just because they were no longer active military didn't mean they weren't currently working for some other part of the South African government, like its intelligence division. But if that were the case, why would they have been involved in wiping out a charitable medical clinic and the adjacent village? Harvath felt far more certain that the men were mercenaries of some sort, contractors. That, of course, brought up all sorts of questions. Most importantly, who had hired them, and what had they been hired to do? In order to get that answer, he was going to have a little talk with their head man. But before that could happen, they were going to ID him. 12 hours later, the gates opened, and they got a clear view of one of the SUVs leaving. There were only two occupants, a driver in his 40s and a passenger somewhere in his 60s. Nicholas confirmed that the black phone was in the vehicle and on the move. Harvath sent him the pictures they had taken. An hour later, Nicholas called back. He had identified their target.
"The older man is your guy. His name is Jan Hendrik," he said as he transmitted the man's service record to Harvath's computer. "All of the men we have ID'd so far served under him. Hendrik was their commanding officer."
"What else do we know?"
"Nothing. I can't find anything. No credit card bills, no parking tickets. They're ghosts."
Harvath scrolled through several of the photos on his laptop. These guys might be good at covering their tracks, but they were still men, and men made mistakes, even the best of them, especially when the right pressure was applied. Pulling up satellite footage of the neighborhood, Harvath gestured Ash over and began to lay out his plan. Chapter 24. The jammer Nicholas had sent had been born out of necessity in Iraq. U.S. troops used much larger versions to help disrupt cell phone and other wireless transmissions as their vehicles were rolled. This, in turn, made it incredibly difficult for the enemy to remotely detonate roadside bombs. On one of his ops in Syria, Harvath had used a similar device to to part a terrorist from the civilians he was hiding behind so that he could take him out. He was hoping to conduct a similar operation here. The problem, though, was that his current target was much more sophisticated, and there were several additional layers of difficulty. Putting a bag over someone's head was always more dangerous and more complicated than laying up on a rooftop and putting a bullet between their eyes. Harvath would know. He had done both, many times. The unknown element was buy-in from Asher and his men. While their SAS motto was, "Who dares wins," Harvath had taken them far beyond their agreed-to scope of work. Escorting a doctor and a civilian representative from a medical charity was one thing, but snatching a former South African Special Forces operator off the streets of Bunia was something entirely different. Harvath figured he had one thing going for him. If Ash and his team hadn't been interested, they would have already taken off. Technically, they had completed their assignment. Harvath and Decker had been returned to Bunia safe and sound. They had fulfilled the terms of their contract, and then some. Now, everything came down to what they wanted, and even more importantly, what they needed. Harvath understood the men all too well. There was a reason they had become contractors instead of fishing guides or boat builders, and it went beyond them being good at what they did. Harvath probably could go up and go to Wall Street at any time and make a killing, but that wasn't what he wanted. It wasn't what he needed. He needed this. He needed the action. That was why he kept coming back. He was pretty good at it, and it still scared the hell out of him time and time again. But it was exhilarating. It was a rush he couldn't get anywhere else. He craved it like a drug, and like a drug, he would put it before everything else. Even a trip to see the leaves turn colors with someone he professed was very important to him. A common joke among operators was, "Don't be that guy." It meant, don't be the guy who does something stupid and screws up. But it was also a warning to never do anything you'd regret. Harvath knew that if he got out of the business, he would regret it. He also knew that there was nothing more lamentable than a former action guy who pined for his gunfighting days. Harvath never wanted to be that guy. And so, he had stayed hard, and he had stayed in. He risked being shot, stabbed, and blown to pieces, all because he loved giving death the finger as he sped on by. Was it immature? Maybe. But the fact was that he was better when he was out here. At home, he drank and recharged, ate and worked out, all the while looking forward to not knowing where the next assignment was going to take him, and all the while saying he wanted a family if he could just find the right person. But he had found the right people, repeatedly. Incredible women who would have done anything for him, and yet it hadn't worked out. It wasn't about the women. It was obviously about him. He wanted his cake and to eat it too. It wasn't impossible. Other people balanced dangerous, high-speed careers with family. Why not him? It was a question he hadn't been able to answer, at least not until a naked Jessica Decker had tried to climb in the shower with him. That had crystallized it. He was loyal. Loyalty meant honoring the promises you made to other people, whether it was an oath of service or the rules of your relationship. But there was something more to it than that, especially when it came to relationships. It meant that you didn't just think about yourself. You had to think about that other person. That's what Decker had helped him realize. That's what his problem was. He was successful because he pushed everything right to the razor's edge. He liked pushing it to that edge. The harder the mission, the more he enjoyed it. It came partly from who he was and how he was raised. His father had taught him to push and keep pushing. It was the SEAL in him. When Harvath became a SEAL himself, they took him to a completely new level. The only easy day was yesterday. Failure is not an option, and never quit were SEAL mottos that had become a part of him. They were so deeply burned into who he was that they impacted every decision he made. But how could he look at a woman and say, "As much as I love you, my job will always come first"? Didn't that mean failure when it came to that relationship? Was it selfish? Was it immature? Unfair? But as frank and as honest as he thought he was being with himself, there was something else tapping at the back of his mind. This was not the time to be trying to get to the truth, but he was closer to it than he had ever felt before. Jesus, he thought, this job is like a drug. It fought like crazy to keep you hooked. It also provided great moments of euphoria, along with some amazing moments of clarity. Instead of slamming the iron door of his mind shut, as was his practice, he decided to leave it open and focus his mind elsewhere. Maybe the answer he was looking for would come, maybe it wouldn't. As long as the job got done, that was what mattered for the moment. The remaining items Harvath needed were not small, but with the help of a stack of currency, Jumbo and his relatives had taken care of them in the blink of an eye. Mick had gone along with them to do the assessment and had given it his approval. With the final pieces in place, they were ready for their operation to go dynamic. As Harvath powered up the jammer, Ash shook his head in disbelief.
"Bloody amazing technology," he said. "I never would have thought to use it like this."
"Any job's easy if you've got the correct tool, right?"
"But you're sawing boards with a hammer, mate. It's brilliant."
Harvath smiled and turned his attention back to the jammer. He had been right about Ash and his team. If the money was right, they were happy to be on board, especially with the action factor so high. Harvath had provided more excitement in the last couple of days than they had seen in the last couple of years. It had been a long time since they had played cowboys and Indians. If the truth be told, they would have stuck with Harvath even if there was no money left to be made. What had happened at the clinic and to those villagers was horrific. It was an affront to their sense of honor. If they could help settle that score, they were 100% on board and wouldn't quit until every last person responsible had been brought to justice. It was about doing what was right. Like Harvath, they believed in standing up for those who couldn't stand up for themselves. With the jammer ready to go, Harvath hailed Nicholas and got ready for their first test. He would operate it remotely from the United States. When the time came, Harvath would need to be on the street, not up in the apartment pressing buttons.
"Okay," he said, "whenever you're ready."
"Roger that," Nicholas said over his earpiece. "Stand by."
Mick looked at the jammer and said,
"It's that accurate? You can focus on a single phone? It doesn't simply shut down the entire block?"
"Let's watch," Harvath replied.
Several lights on the jammer changed colors as Nicholas manipulated its levels from back in the United States. There was a slight lag in what he could see from the camera's feed, but not so much that it would make a difference. There was an art to this, and Harvath had been very specific about what he wanted. If he drove the black phone straight into the dirt, Hendrik might become suspicious. It was better that everyone in the house experience some signal drop at first. It was Congo, after all. Shit happened. The Brute Squad was the first to notice movement inside the house.
"I've got someone at the window," Eddie said over the radio. "Second floor, northwest corner. Looks like he has his phone in his hand and is trying to find a better signal."
"Make sure to keep taking pictures," Harvath replied.
"Roger that."
Cell phones had gone beyond being simple electronic devices. They had actually become part of people. Harvath was convinced that every time a person's phone chimed, that a little blast of dopamine was released into the brain. It was like watching monkeys press on a bar for food. People were constantly looking at them, just in case a text or an email had come in. Take their phone away from them, even if only for a few moments, and they started to go into withdrawal.
"We've got movement in the courtyard," Ash said.
Mick joined him at the window.
"Oh, look at this guy," he laughed. "He's spinning around like he's got one foot nailed to the ground. Raise your phone higher, you twat. That's it. Up over your head. Now jump up and down on your left leg and see if that helps your signal, you tosser."
Harvath smiled and asked in the room and over the radio,
"Any sign of Hendrik yet?"
"We've got activity at the door on the west side," Eddie replied.
"What do you see?"
"Stand by." "Nothing yet."
"Roger that," Harvath replied. "Standing by." They all watched their respective areas of responsibility. Harvath was glued to the remote rooftop cameras.
"Okay, got him,"
Eddie finally said.
"It's our guy. It's Hendrik."
"You're positive?"
"Yes, it's him."
With that confirmation, Harvath instructed Nicholas to slowly bring the signal strength back up to normal.
"Cracking!"
Mick exclaimed as he turned away from the window and flashed Harvath a thumbs up.
"Time to have fun."
Harvath nodded.
"Roger that. Time to have fun."
Chapter 25. Asher knew his men better than Harvath, so once the plan was firmed up, he decided who would take what role. With Jumbo driving the van he had borrowed, Harvath and Asher would do the snatch. Mick would drive one of the land cruisers as a follow car, and Simon and Eddie would take sniper positions on two different rooftops. One of Jumbo's cousins would sit in LC2 with the engine running a block away, ready to pick up the brute squad once they had pulled back. If everything went well, the job would be over in 15 minutes. They all knew, though, that if something could go wrong, it would go wrong. So they developed a set of contingencies, and after checking their weapons and equipment, sanitized the apartments. They wouldn't be coming back. Mick would take the jammer with him in LC1 and run it off a converter. It was designed to be mobile, and Nicholas could still control it remotely from back in the United States. Starting from several blocks over, they drove back and forth to the new safe house Jumbo's relatives had arranged. It was just outside of town and remote enough that no one would know they were there. They familiarized themselves with the roads, using a different route each time, until they felt they had everything as figured out as they could. The key was to pull this off as quietly as possible. Hendrik's men were going to turn Bunya upside down to find their boss. And if they had any pull whatsoever with MONUSCO, there would be thousands of soldiers helping them beat the bushes. Everything would come down to timing and staying as far beneath the radar as possible. With one last radio check, Harvath and Ash climbed into the van, slid the door shut, and instructed Jumbo to move out. As they drove toward their target, Harvath kept in touch with Nicholas and Mick, while Ash fed him situation reports from Simon and Eddie, who were watching the White House from their rooftop perches. Once they arrived on their mark and had the van where they wanted it, Harvath stepped out and said to Nicholas,
"Start throttling him down, slowly."
"Roger,"
Nicholas replied.
Looking at Ash, he said,
"Ready?"
The Brit nodded, and he and Harvath took their places around the corner. Regardless of which door Hendrik exited, Nicholas could play hot or cold by increasing or decreasing the cell signal based on which direction the man moved. As long as he continued on the path they wanted, his signal would continue to get warmer. They didn't need him to go far. When he turned the corner, Harvath and Ash would throw a bag over his head, toss him in the van, and speed away.
"I've got movement," Eddie said over the radio. "West door, same as before."
"Can you ID who it is?"
Harvath asked.
"Negative. Stand by."
Everyone held their breath. They tensed, coiled like springs ready to jump. Seconds passed.
"Got him,"
Eddie finally said.
"It's definitely Hendrik."
"Roger that,"
replied Harvath.
"Lead him to us."
"Will do,"
said Eddie, as he then communicated over his cell phone with Nicholas so he could manipulate the jammer accordingly. Everything was going smoothly. Hendrik was nearing the corner when Simon's voice came over the radio.
"You've got company," he said. "A woman and two children just stepped out of a building half a block down, headed in your direction."
Jumbo, who was monitoring the radio from inside the van, didn't need to be told what to do. Harvath had placed his relatives at different positions nearby, and Jumbo was already on his cell phone relaying instructions. Moments later, Simon said,
"You're all clear."
Harbath hoped that would be the extent of any interference. Eddie began a countdown of how many feet Hendrik was from turning the corner.
4 feet out, he radioed. 3 feet now. 2.
But then, he suddenly stopped. Once again, everyone held their breath.
He's holding one of the phones up.
Come on, Harbath said to himself. You're almost there. Just a couple more feet.
Back in the United States, Nicholas boosted the signal and then dropped it. It was the push Hendrik needed, and he stepped around the corner. As he did, Harbath and Asher were waiting. Ash landed the first blow. It was a punch to the gut that caused Hendrik to double over. Harbath brought his fist down between the man's shoulder blades, knocking the wind from his lungs and sending him the rest of the way to the ground. As Ash placed the bag over his head, Harbath zip-tied his hands behind his back. By the time he looked up to see where the van was, Jumbo had already pulled up and had the sliding door open. Harbath and Ash picked Hendrik up by his arms and chucked him inside. Ash climbed in after him as Harbath picked up the 2 cell phones. Jumbo was already pulling away as Harbath jumped in and slid the door closed. He patted Hendrik down for weapons as Ash zip-tied his ankles. He found a Browning High Power with 2 spare magazines, as well as a folding knife in his pocket and a fixed blade in his boot. He carried cash, as well as a blue United Nations laissez-passer. It acted like a travel document and was only supposed to be used for official United Nations travel. Popping the covers off both of the phones, Harbath removed their batteries and put all of the pieces in his pocket. Hendrik was gasping, trying to get the air back into his lungs. Neither Harbath nor Ash spoke. As he was a Special Forces operator, they were aware of the kind of SEER training Hendrik would have had. SEER stood for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. Once his breath had fully returned, he was going to try to sort out what was going on. His mind would be calculating the odds of all different kinds of situations. Whatever situation he was most afraid of would weigh on him the heaviest. That's what Harbath wanted him focused on. The more unsettled and stressed out he was, the better. A man with Hendrik's background wasn't going to be easy to break. They took a circuitous route, partly to make sure they weren't being followed, and partly to disorient Hendrik as much as possible. The less he knew, the better. When the van came to a stop at the safe house on the outskirts of Bunia, Hendrik's body tensed. Harbath slid the door open, and Asher nudged the South African to move forward. He refused. So pulling his arm back, Asher slammed his left elbow through the hood and into Hendrik's mouth. A stream of blood and saliva ran over his chin, down his neck, and stained the front of his shirt. Harbath stepped out of the van and dragged Hendrik with him. Laying the man face down in the dirt, he used his knife to slice through the restraints binding his ankles. He and Ash then lifted him to his feet and guided him to a shed at the rear of the property. It was a stifling, unventilated space that smelled like gasoline and animal dung. It was not intended to be pleasant. A metal chair had been placed in the middle of the shed. Hendrik was walked over to it and made to sit down. Ash zip-tied his left leg to the left leg of the chair and did the same on the right side. He then re-zip-tied his arms to the arms of the chair. If Hendrik had resisted or tried to lash out in any way, Asher had been prepared to punch him in a very sensitive part of his anatomy. Hendrik, though, had not resisted. He had not even spoken. While Ash kept an eye on their prisoner, Harbath walked back to the house. Everything he had asked for was there. Stacking as much of it as he could in a metal washtub, he walked back out to the shed. Mick and the Brute Squad had arrived. With all of the vehicles now inside the gate, Jumbo locked it and then helped his relatives cover the van with a tarp. Simon and Eddie took guard duty while Mick helped carry the rest of the supplies out to the shed. He had already been told not to speak. In his mind, Harbath walked through how best to choreograph the next step. The operation had come together so fast and with so little actionable intelligence, it was difficult to decide what the right move was. By now, Hendrick's men knew something had happened. They were well-trained and would move quickly. They would start by canvassing the neighborhood. And while Harvath and his team had done all they could to minimize the potential risk of any witnesses, he had to assume that someone had seen something. Eventually, Hendrick's men were going to begin piecing things together. The weakest link in Harvath's plan would then become the airport. Once Hendrick's men figured out that his abductors had been white, and thereby likely foreigners, they would be all over it. At the very least, they would post a man there, and depending on their pull with MONUSCO, they might be able to ramp up security screening or even shut it down. Harvath didn't want to find out. He needed to move fast, stay ahead of them. That was why Jan Hendrick would only get one opportunity to cooperate. If he refused, Harvath would have no choice but to crank things all the way up and rip off the knob. Chapter 26. When time was on your side, interrogations could take as long as you wanted. They could play out over hours, days, or even weeks. With long-term detainees, interrogations could stretch months or even years. It all depended on how quickly you needed the information and what lengths you were willing to go to get it. When time was a key factor, Harvath's definition of what was acceptable broadened dramatically. He nodded, and Asher flipped on the blinding halogen lights that had been set up on stands. Walking over to Hendrick, he pulled the bag from his head. The man squinted and tried to get a look at Harvath, but the lights were too bright. All he saw standing in front of him was a silhouette.
"Mr. Hendrick," Harvath began, "I am well aware of your background and your training, so I won't insult you by trying to build some sort of rapport. You have information I want, and I am in a hurry. If you cooperate, this will be over fast. If you don't cooperate, this will still be over fast, but it'll be much more painful for you. I'll give you one chance to answer my questions. If you lie to me, or if I feel you are being evasive, all bets are off. Understand that I will go to any lengths necessary to extract from you the information I need. Is that clear?"
"Who are you?" Hendrick demanded.
Harvath gave the man an open-handed slap across the side of his face.
"That was for being evasive. You don't ask the questions, I do."
The South African spat a gob of blood onto the floor, squinted at him, and replied,
"You're American."
This time, Harvath hit him in the same spot, but with his fist. The blow was so hard it rocked him to the point of almost tipping over in his chair.
"Fuck you,"
said Hendrick once he had recovered. Harvath was done playing games. Striking him again, he demanded,
"Why were you at the Matumani clinic?"
"Fuck you,"
the man repeated. Harvath put the bag back over his head and nodded to Ash and Mick. The two men circled around behind the South African's chair, grabbed hold of it, and tipped it backward. As soon as they did, Harvath began pouring water through the fabric over his face. Hendrick's body tensed, and he began to thrash wildly. Harvath stopped pouring the water, and the Brits leaned him upright.
"Why were you at the Matumani clinic, Jan?"
Hendrick coughed and spat up water as he tried to catch his breath. Harvath gave him several more seconds, and when he didn't answer, he nodded for the Brits to tip him over again, and he once more began pouring the water. Exhausting his first pitcher, Harvath reached for a second. Hendrick thrashed even harder than before. The tactic was inelegant but simple. He took no pleasure in it. It was simply a tool in the toolbox. All Hendrick had to do was cooperate, and it would be over.
"Why were you at the Matumani clinic?"
Harvath asked, as he eased up on the water. The South African sputtered and hacked from beneath his hood, trying to clear the water from his airway.
"Whoever pays you, Jan, isn't paying you enough to go through this. Tell me why you were there, and I'll make it stop."
Hendrick managed a third,
"Fuck you!"
It went on and on.
The floor was puddled with water, and Harvath's shoes as well as his trousers were soaked. When pitcher number two was empty, he started in on number three. The South African was one tough son of a bitch, but no one could hold out indefinitely. Everyone broke under waterboarding. It was only a matter of time. Hendrik was about to reach his breaking point.
"Humanitarian!"
he gurgled from beneath his drenched hood as he coughed and vomited up water. Harvath motioned for the chair to be righted and waited for the man to catch his breath. Once he had, Harvath asked,
"What did you say?"
Even when the hardest of men cracked, what they said had to be treated as suspect until independently confirmed. Sometimes things came pouring out in an obscure torrent. What they said could be true, could be the effect of psychological torment, or it could be complete and total bullshit. Harvath motioned Ash and Mick back behind the lights. Once they were there, he pulled off Hendrik's hood.
"Listen to me," he said. "If you lie to me, you're going back under the water. Do you understand?"
Hendrik shook his head from side to side, confused. Harvath slapped him and reached for another pitcher.
"It was a humanitarian operation," he said feebly,
trying to focus.
"A humanitarian operation?" Harvath said. "You wipe out a clinic and cremate an entire village and call that a humanitarian operation?
It needed to be contained. More would have died."
"What needed to be contained?"
"The infection."
"What infection?"
Hendrik didn't reply, and so Harvath slapped him again.
"One of the patients got out,"
the South African stammered.
"From the Matumeni clinic? What are you talking about?"
Hendrik failed to answer, so Harvath picked his hood back up and began to put it back over his head.
"Not Matumeni,"
he said as the hood came down.
"Ngoa."
Harvath pulled it back up.
"What's Ngoa?"
"A village. There's a WHO facility there. A lab."
"A World Health Organization lab?" The man nodded.
"What were they working on?"
"I don't know,"
Hendrik replied. The answer came a little too quickly for Harvath's liking. There was also the flash of a micro-expression that told him the South African was lying. Fixing his gaze on Hendrik, he said,
"You're lying to me. What happens when you lie?"
"I'm not lying,"
he pleaded, as Harvath roughly pulled the hood down over his head and waved the Brits back over. Harvath picked the pitcher back up as Ash and Mick tilted the chair backward.
"Hemorrhagic fever,"
the man yelled.
"They were experimenting with African hemorrhagic fever."
"Like Ebola?"
"Worse."
"How much worse?"
Harvath demanded. Hendrik refused to respond, so Harvath started pouring water again over his nose and mouth.
"They found a way to weaponize it."
Harvath poured again.
"Tell me how."
"Airborne,"
the South African confessed, shaking his head back and forth, trying to make the water stop.
"They found a way to make it airborne."
Chapter 27. Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Clifton, the luxury 411-acre estate and farm, an hour outside Washington, D.C., had belonged to George Washington's cousin, Warner Washington. Pierre Damien loved it as much for its history as he did for its exquisite classical revival manor house and the panoramic views of the Blue Ridge Mountains. George Washington had spent extensive time on the property, and when Damien walked the grounds, he liked to imagine himself walking in the footsteps of history. Damien wondered, if Washington were alive today, would he see the world the same way? Would Washington realize that in a modern era such as this, certain viewpoints and philosophies of government had run their course? Wouldn't such a noble man realize that individual, selfish pursuits only serve to harm mankind, not advance it? And as a farmer, a true man of the soil, certainly Washington would recognize the responsibilities that all human beings had to the planet. Taking a deep breath of crisp fall air,
Damien breathed in the scent of nature. The colors along the distant mountains were extraordinary. There was no better place to be in autumn. Of all the properties he owned, even his private key in the Bahamas, Clifton was his favorite. It was why he had wanted to bring Helena here. That, and there were final preparations to be made. Tonight would be the organization's last dinner for some time. The Tiny Thomas Malthus Society didn't have a website or a mailing address. Its membership was one of the most closely guarded secrets in D.C. The society was based on the teachings of the 18th century cleric and scholar, Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus, particularly his An Essay on the Principle of Population. Influential in the fields of political economy and demography, Malthus believed that a utopian society could never be achieved as long as the world's population was allowed to continue to grow unchecked. The only way to protect the earth and improve the existence of mankind was to have less of mankind, something he believed Mother Nature would eventually deliver in the form of widespread famine and disease. The anticipated population reduction event was popularly and rather dramatically known as the Malthusian Catastrophe. It had yet to happen, but there were those who not only believed it necessary, but who were eager to help usher it forward. They simply referred to it as the event. Some of those people lived and worked in Washington, D.C. By custom, the dinner's ingredients were locally sourced. Tonight, all of it came from Clifton. There would be fresh herbs, lettuce, radishes, sorrel, chives, and garlic, as well as farm-raised lamb shoulder and duck breast, foie gras emulsion, and goat's milk and sheep's milk cheeses. The pièce de résistance was dessert. George Washington was an ice cream fanatic. In his honor, Damien served fresh, hand-cranked strawberry ice cream from an actual Washington family recipe. There were organic wine pairings, an incredible vintage port, and the most delicious, fresh-roasted certified free trade coffee any of the guests had ever tasted. The dinner party was a huge hit, as the guests had known it would be. Damien was a man of both astounding wealth and impeccable taste. It was the society's best dinner of the year. The conversation, as usual, revolved around domestic and international affairs, but also included science, mathematics, literature, the arts, and culture. These were incredibly erudite men and women. The depth and breadth of their intelligence was equaled only by their power, and that's why Damien had selected them. He knew a thing or two about power, small truths that others often failed to realize. Heads of agencies and their immediate underlings would come and go, subject to election cycles and political approval. The same was true of politicians. Their influence was only worth so much. The truly powerful were those deepest inside the government. Like the Wizard of Oz, they were the ones behind the curtain. They were the ones who knew which ropes to pull. Their hands were on the very levers of power. They could not only raise or lower the sets, but also brighten or dim the house lights.